Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
In the new book, Killers of the King, Charles Spencer relates for the first time the shocking stories and fascinating fates of the 59 men who signed Charles I of England's death warrant in 1649. This act not only changed British history forever, reverberated across the ocean to the young British colonies in America, which more than 100 years later also rose up against their king. Again, the name of the book is Killers of the King, the men who dared to execute Charles I, and we welcome Charles Spencer to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Well, it's a huge pleasure. Thank you.
What brought you to the project of wanting to look into this in such detail?
Well, I've written a few history books before, and I just couldn't find a subject that really grabbed me, and I have quite a lot of things going on in my life. So I was waiting for something to really bowl me over, and this did. I was on a very obscure website called executedtoday.com, would you believe? And a name leapt out at me, and it was the 350th anniversary, the day I was on that website, of the death of a man I knew from a previous history book dealing with our civil wars in England, which took place in the 1640s. And I thought, wow, he was put to death, it said, for killing the king. And I wanted to know who else had done it, why they had done it, who they were, and what happened to them. And that was the genesis of this book.
How much do you think, and I guess you could answer this question in two ways, how much do you think is known in your country and ultimately in ours about this chapter of history?
Well, nothing in England, and so I assume pretty much the same in America.
Yes.
I mean, that was the surprising thing. When I put this to my publishers, they said, well, why hasn't someone written this before? And of course, that's a thrilling question to have put to you. But I suppose, you know, in terms of just the mechanics, this is not a period of English history that is particularly taught. Yes, our civil war is, just like your civil wars over here dominate a lot of your history lessons. But the little period afterwards, no, it's not considered particularly relevant. So I don't know. It had just been left alone. It was a fallow field, and it was my joy to find it.
So where did you begin in looking at this story? Because ultimately you wanted to look at the men who were involved and look at how that came about, this extraordinary act, and how it actually worked through the timeline.
Yes. Well, I thought, well, I did know there was one King of England, Charles I, who was tried and executed, and that I didn't know an enormous amount about it otherwise. But when I started to get down to it, I realized that this was a moment, just not just a politics. You know, our civil war was between the king and against Parliament, and the king had a view of his own powers as being coming only from God, and therefore, you know, he didn't need to answer to anything as trivial as Parliament or the people. And I set about finding the documents. You know, I started with court documents. The trial of the king is well documented, and then the trials of the men who were scooped up after his son returned. You know, there was a sort of a decade in the middle of the 17th century where England had no king. It seems so odd to us now, but that was the case. And then it was really the vengeance story I wanted. You know, when the king's son, Charles II, came back to England, welcomed as king because the country was in chaos, he set about hunting these men down. And it was remarkably well documented, the trials in particular, but also letters and diaries and books by the main people involved. So, yeah, it was a logistical headache, but I knew straight away the story was really, really strong, and I used to sort of almost skip with joy to my desk each day, either researching or writing it.
You, of course, this is a bit of a personal story in the sense of being a direct descendant of King Charles I.
Yes.
For you as 9th Earl Spencer. So how much was known of the family lineage that you could go on, and how much was really digging and finding new sources?
Well, there's a certain amount that is sort of out there which people would know about Charles I. What really surprised me, though, was when I was looking at these 59 men who signed this death warrant. I mean, I found out that I was descended from two of them, too. So it just shows how intertwined this story can get. And I didn't even know about these men before. And, you know, one was a lord and one was a general, and they were among the conspirators to be rid of the king. So that was a big surprise. But I tell you, it's probably the same with people who cover your civil war here, that they take one side or the other when they're writing. And I didn't feel the need for that. You know, for me, history is about people watching, man watching, seeing basically how we as a species have changed so little over the hundreds of years of recent history. And so it's personality driven. It's, I hope, factually correct. But I really wanted to see how people react in very extreme circumstances. You know, the bits that really intrigued me was, what was Charles I saying on his way to being beheaded outside one of his palaces in London? And what did these men do, you know, 12 years later when they were being tried for their lives and made to suffer a terrible, terrible death of hanging, drawing, and quartering? What was going through their minds? What were they trying to justify, and what were they sorry about? And I think history, when you look at it in human terms, it can teach us a lot about the human condition.
How did these 59 men come together in this one mission of wanting to assassinate a monarch?
I think what happened, you know, just like your Civil War is such a bloody episode in America's history, our English Civil War is also the bloodiest conflict that Britain's ever suffered in terms of percentage of loss of life. And the people on the other side of the king were just fed up with him, just starting more and more warfare, saying one thing to their face when he was defeated in warfare, but still trying to resurrect the bloodshed. And as is always the case, if you want to find justification for a cause, you only have to look in the Bible. And there was a very obscure verse in the Book of Numbers in the Old Testament which said, if you want to rid a land of bloodshed, you have to identify and then put to death that man of blood who caused it. So a lot of these people who were fighting against the king were very earnest Puritans, and they sincerely believed that Charles was that man of blood, and that the only hope for the country was putting him to death. So it's quite interesting. What I found out was, apart from one man, I don't think any of the ones who put Charles to death actually hated him as an individual. They just thought they were doing the right thing by their religion and by their country.
Did they know that eventually retribution would come when Charles II was restored to the throne?
Well, it's an interesting point. I mean, some of them on the scaffold did say, look, you know, we were guilty of putting a king to death and we thought this might happen. But, you know, the restoration of Charles II, this sudden rescue, really, of a penniless prince living abroad, unable to pay his hotel bill in places he was sort of finding refuge, to suddenly coming back as the all-powerful King of England and able to dish out vengeance. It was such a sudden reversal, and that's part of the joy of this story. You know, a lot of the men who decided to put the king to death came from very humble origins. They had risen either in the army or through politics, through their own merit. And then they had the power in this extraordinary moment of world history, really, of putting a king to death. They then had a decade in the sunshine being the most prominent men in the land. And then with the king's son coming back with vengeance in mind, they became the most hated of criminals. And I love the roller coaster that this involves. That it's so topsy-turvy, but at the end of the day, you see the best of human nature, bravery, stoicism, etc., and the worst, sort of cowardice and turning on each other and trying to justify the unjustifiable.
You also talk in the book about the repercussions. I mean, the ripples that this sent, not just immediately, but over centuries, over time. And I'm curious as to how you look at it now, of what impact this has had on our history and of course, British history.
Yes, well, actually, I think the most striking piece of history that I noticed with regard to America was, I hadn't appreciated that up until these events, New Haven had been its own independent colony. And the reason New Haven lost its independence was because King Charles II, sitting in London, was well aware that two of the men who had killed his father were hiding in or around New Haven, and he got fed up with the people of New Haven not tracking these killers down and handing them over for punishment in England. So he had New Haven's independence struck out and had the colony of New Haven forcibly absorbed by Connecticut. So that is a fairly major piece of major result from this very bizarre and wrongly forgotten part of history. And then also the background to the story when I'm covering it is that the years in the 1660s when New York stopped being Dutch property and fell into English hands. And there was a suspicion that because New York was seen as this very, well, New Amsterdam then, before it became New York, was seen as this sort of lawless place where anything could go and nobody had any jurisdiction really. That a lot of these killers were hiding on Manhattan, which actually turned out probably not to be the case. But it just shows how the world view at that time was that Manhattan was this seething place where the most wanted people in history could be just forgotten. And it's just a fascinating little snap of the new world becoming more identifiable as the world we know of it today and not just this early colonial history that we're so used to.
Do you have a sense, especially in living part time in this country and covering issues for so many years, obviously as the brother of the late Princess Diana, do you have a sense of what fascinates us as Americans when it comes to not only British history but the monarchy in general?
Yeah, I'm always amazed. You know, I spend probably 10 days a month in the States. And I'm always amazed if I have one of the breakfast news network shows on in the background, how very often stories about the British monarchy, today's monarchy, come up. And I don't know. I think that there is a genuine interest. Otherwise, the networks wouldn't bother to cover it. And I put it down to a sort of, among the average American who is interested in this stuff, it sort of must seem so otherworldly that people still wear crowns and have authority, even though it's, of course, very limited politically, but that this sort of vestige of fairy tales can go on actually existing not so far away in the world, in a country which speaks the same language but has so many different cultures.
And it is currently a monarchy that continues to change and shift and obviously will soon be entering a very new phase.
Yes, I mean, I was interested. I was looking at the popularity of the monarchy in Britain, inside of Britain, and over 80% of people think it's a good thing. And the next generation or two of royals have a lot of popularity, so you know, you can never judge what's going to happen, but it looks like a very strong institution. And as a historian, I look back, I mean, I was looking at events 100 years ago in one of my ancestors' diaries, and there were calls, you know, going back, 1910 or so, for the monarchy seriously to be put out to grass as this ridiculous institution. And, you know, you still hear those voices today, but it does continue. It's this extraordinarily clever institution at just surviving and fitting in with whatever is acceptable, and it means a lot emotionally to an awful lot of people in England.
The name of the new book is Killers of the King, The Men Who Dared to Execute Charles I. It is published by Bloomsbury Press. Charles Spencer, thank you so much for spending time with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
I enjoyed it a lot. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is Killers of the King by Charles Spencer. The book is published by Bloomsbury. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.